Blog Talk Radio.
Everybody, Movie Geeks United is back. Another live show, I think like our first in about 3 weeks.
I think you're right. I think you're absolutely right. Welcome back,
Jerry.
I just want to bring up something. I just loaded our page, and the first thing I see is Adam Sandler and himself is his twin sister on that picture of Jack and Jill. That's scary, man.
I mean, if that doesn't warn you off against tonight's show, I don't know how well. We're going to talk about that, because I have some thoughts
curious
on that.
To hear what you have to say. I didn't see it, so I'm curious to hear about
you're
it.
You're missing out, man.
That's the impression I'm under.
Tonight, Joshua Leonard, you know, we've talked to the core Blair Witch Project talents, except for Heather Donahue, because she's like self-imposed exiled. Have we heard from Heather Donahue really much at all since Blair Witch?
No, not to my knowledge. I mean, I think like initially after that, there were some roles or something, and then after that, nothing. It's been like 10 years, and I'm curious if Eduardo Sanchez, because he lives right up the road from me, actually, or went to school, high school right up the road from me. I wonder if he still talks to her, but, you know, I'd be curious to, that's got to be a weird situation. That's going to be a very weird experience.
To be part of a phenomenon, your first time out, you're always going to be known for it. No matter what else you do, you might do something else that's lucky enough to catch on and become another kind of cultural hit.
Right.
But Blair Witch will be the albatross that you carry with you the rest of your life.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe she didn't want that. Maybe she decided that acting wasn't necessarily her passion anymore. And I wonder how much that initial success played into that decision, if that was her decision not to pursue it anymore.
Yeah. Right. That's a good point. That's an interesting point.
I mean, I'm sure everyone just begs for a big hit. Most people would.
Yeah.
But once you get that, and plus, once you get that in a movie like that, where it's played as if you're essentially playing yourself.
True.
You know? I mean, there's not really... I think they use their real names in the movie. Yeah, they do. Yeah. So it was essentially, it was trying to look like a documentary.
Right.
I don't know. But we've been unable to get her, as has anyone. But we've spoken to the everyone else involved in Blair Witch, but except Joshua Leonard, and we finally got him tonight. He's got a great new movie out called The Lie.
Mm-hmm.
He had a great movie last year called Hump Day.
That's right.
He's doing really well. I mean, he's built a great career for himself as one of the most dependable independent actors in film.
Right.
I said that wrong. One of the most dependable actors in independent film.
It was interesting. Either way, I think we know what you're trying to say.
Thank you. I'm sure he's an independent actor too. But so anyway, he's on the show, and one of our favorite filmmakers, Kurt Keen. His film, Dear Zachary.
That was a great movie. That was a really great film. You recommended that to me, and I watched it a couple of years ago. A really good film.
Is there a more heartbreaking film ever? It's staggering. He has a new film out called Shuffle. We're going to be talking about that with him. And we're premiering a couple of film scores tonight, including John Williams' new score for War Horse, which is the new Steven Spielberg movie. And it's a classic Williams score.
Yeah, I'll buy it. I'll buy it before I see the film. I mean, it sounds. I mean, I can't wait to see the movie. But it sounds like a beautiful score.
Yeah, it's gorgeous. So, we've been gone 3 weeks, and the reason why is because we've been putting together this show on The Shining for the Kubrick series, and it's finally aired on Sunday.
Yeah.
Oh, thank God.
That was an awesome show. I mean, you did a bang-up job on that. That was really quite – I mean, I think that's everything you could possibly want to know about The Shining. I mean, people are going to be going back to that for years. I mean
– I hope so.
I think so. I mean, come on. You have so much interest in the show. This series, I mean, people are going back to them. But before we get into that, you always post something with the Criterion new releases.
Right.
And in February, I mean, kind of hit the jackpot with this one film that I've wanted to see since I first read about it. It's a Japanese film, Three Outlaw Samurai, and it's been unavailable in this country. I've been looking for it for like 8 years. And they're going to release it. I would buy that sight unseen on Blu-ray. I haven't bought much on anything lately, but I would buy that, hands down. It's supposed to
so
be an incredible movie.
That's been hidden for a long time or what?
Yeah, I've seen other films by the director. I think Sword of the Beast is one that the Criterion put out a couple years ago. And there's another one, Goyankin. There are a couple of movies that he has. Hideo Gosha. But this film, I remember reading about it, just sounded like really, really awesome. And Netflix didn't have it. No, I mean, you could order it, I'm sure, overseas, but I'm not going
to do
that. But Criterion Blu-ray,
that's great.
Worth it. That's worth
it. I tell you, is there any better company for a movie fanatic than Criterion? I mean,
yeah,
I even said it's like Christmas every month when they announce their titles. I've got 12 Angry Men and The Rules of the Game that I can't wait to delve into. And I mean, they're just great. And also in February, Anatomy of a Murder. I know they got that. Louis Malle? Did they have a Louis Malle? I forget the other title.
Two Claude Chabrol movies, either this or might have just come out or are coming out. But they also have. It's weird, but it's also weird that some of the newer films they have Tiny Furniture coming out, which I was just like, really? Okay. I mean that's more power to Lena Dunham. She'll definitely get a lot of people will check it out, who might have missed it. But
it's eclectic. I mean that's part of their appeal. And also, I mean, just next month they have the Blu-ray Traffic.
Right.
The Soderbergh film. And Godzilla, not the Roland Emmerich, but the 1950s Japanese-American
I will probably get that on Blu-ray. I mean, that and the Three Outlaw Samurai, I'll definitely get on Blu-ray. I mean, this is a great, every couple of months, they really hit it out of the park. I mean, so these titles you would never expect, and it's just like, wow, that's awesome.
Yeah, I agree. God bless Criterion.
Yeah.
And we are going to have a home entertainment show, hopefully this month, at the end of this month. But this Sunday we have David Cronenberg, so that'll be a big one. What would you ask Cronenberg?
For Keira Knightley's phone number? No. I said it. But no, in all seriousness...
could you imagine if that's the first thing I ask him tomorrow morning?
Can I have Keira Knightley's phone number for my co-host? Thank you.
Shortest interview ever.
Yeah, I know. We're like, the hell with these guys. No, I just want to know his path is so interesting. Here's this guy who starts out horror and like sci-fi, and in the last couple of years, completely he always like sort of changes it.
Yeah.
I mean, you got Eastern Promises, A History of Violence, and then Spider. And M. Butterfly, he does whatever he's interested in and doesn't really care. But he's had a very interesting career. I mean,
there was a period of time when that's what he did. He did body horror films.
Right.
And then the one film that you thought, this is perfect for David Cronenberg, was The Fly.
Yeah.
But it was a success artistically in a way we didn't expect, because it worked because it was a love story, which you didn't necessarily expect from David Cronenberg.
No, you didn't, not at all, and that's what really made it really unique. And then the film he follows it up with is one of his craziest, Dead Ringers.
Yeah.
That's wild.
But
movie.
I think that's where the shift happened. Mm-hmm. Where he started out slowly getting away from body horror, but still maintaining those kinds of roots.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Until he finally, M. Butterfly. I mean, you could even categorize that in terms of, body horror.
Oh, yeah.
Unsure. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then he just kind of under the radar, insidiously, switched it up to what he's doing today. His mm-hmm. new movie is A Dangerous Method, and it's way different from anything he's ever done before.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, it looks fantastic. It's just an incredible cast, though. I mean, it's a wild cast. That just must have been either a fun or just an insane shoot.
So tune in Sunday night. We'll play Cronenberg's interview, and you all can hear Keira Knightley's phone number. So,
that's it.
Will that not be the highest rated show ever? Every man in the universe.
Every man in the universe will be listening.
All right, we're going to play Joshua Leonard in just a little bit. And then we'll cover the Oscar news, because we haven't had a chance to discuss that.
That's big.
And then I'd like to discuss J. Edgar and Jack and Jill with you.
Okay, sure, yeah.
Okay.
That's quite a combo.
First, yeah, no, both movies about guys that wear dresses. seriously, is that something?
Yeah.
But first, let's go through some of the reactions from the Kubrick series show.
You're brave.
I don't mind reading.
Okay, no, it's good. I think it's great.
First of all, let me tell everyone that we sincerely appreciate just people listening to the show, but much less taking the time to go to their computer and write an email. And the majority of the reaction for the Kubrick series in general and The Shining in particular has been kind of overwhelmingly positive.
Mm-hmm.
And we've gotten like 15, 16 emails and messages in the past 2 days saying it's the best show you've ever done. It's a great show. I'll never see the movie the same way again, and that's what we love to hear, and we appreciate that you get something out of it.
Right, absolutely.
That being said, here's a couple of emails. Somebody tweeted, "Wow, there is some absolute bullshit in Movie Geeks United's Shining episode. Watching movies backwards is never ever valid. Also." Anything with numbers usually means you're trying way too hard. NASA did hire Kubrick to fake the moon landings, though. That part's spot on. and so I thank the guy for listening. His name is Dave from Virginia. And he said, I love the show. It's just the last three quarters was BS. And the last three quarters of the show Sunday dealt with the theories involving The Shining. And we didn't put those in there to advocate any particular theory or say this is what this movie's about. It was about exploring the phenomenon of a movie that is so kind of ambiguous and open-ended that people bring their own obsessions to it. People read into it whatever obsesses them, generally.
Right.
Whatever their passions are or their point of view or perspective. The movie is so malleable in that kind of way for a lot of people.
Right.
That's the phenomenon of this film that's fascinating to me. And I don't know many other films like it.
Right. No, I agree with you. Yeah, I think, where in Virginia is I might know this, Dave. I'm not sure.
And you can't tell me that, the Jay Widener is the moon landing guy. And even the praise emails we got of praising the show mentioned, you're going to get a lot of crap for bring on Jay Widener, and other than the moon landing guy, it was a great show. But when you're talking about theories, I told a good friend, I said, it's a big circus of everyone with their own opinions.
Right.
And you end the circus with the most outrageous act. And so
right.
we put on Jay Widener at the end. But he's committed to that idea. And he gives you a narrative where you're thinking, oh my God, I could absolutely see how he could derive that from these moments. That doesn't mean it's the gospel truth, and that doesn't make it any less outrageous. But just a glimpse into his thought process concerning The Shining and how that movie accommodates that thought process was fascinating. So that was my thinking behind actually including that. Here's another email. Hi, Jamie, Jerry, Chris, Aaron, and Dean. He's covering all of us.
My name is
Tope. I think that's how you pronounce his name. I'm a listener from Sydney, Australia, and I've been tuning into your wonderful show for almost a year. Your Kubrick series in particular has been quite incredible. He's a big Kubrick fan. He wrote us a long email. And his point in the email basically was to say that Kubrick is an empathetic and compassionate filmmaker, and that's so often missed about his work, and he's thankful that we bring that up in the series. Your show is fantastic, and not just the Kubrick series. I always look forward to your geek-tastic conversations about movies. Thanks a lot. Thank you, Tope. Sydney, Australia. I think it's our first email from Sydney.
Cool.
Joseph Eisenberg. Joseph Eisenberg, by the way, has written a book on Carrie. It's called Studies in the Horror Film. It's about Carrie.
Right, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Comes out next month. Movie Geeks United referenced in it.
Yeah,
sourced
yeah.
in it. We're in print, baby.
Yeah, we are in print. That is a fact.
That legitimizes us somehow.
Yes, it does. Big time.
He listened to the Red Rum show, loved nearly all 3 hours of it, though he can't get with the guy who thinks Jack Torrance is a gay pedophile who's in love with Danny.
Okay, I mean, that's fair. Yeah, I mean, yeah, I can
that's
see that.
I know, that's fair. I mean, I didn't put things in there for everyone to agree with. But he really listens to our shows, and he gives us detailed rundowns of what he thinks of them and his opinions on them. He says he thinks he found an inaccuracy with Jeffrey Cox, his reading of the film as it relates to Lolita, because Jeffrey Cox talked about The Shining including the number 42 all the way through it, and that's a reference to the beginnings of the Holocaust. And he said this has precedent back to Lolita, where Nabokov's novel included the number 42, and Kubrick probably stored that in his mind and used it later for The Shining. Actually,
right.
Lolita uses the number 52, and I looked this up, and it's true. The number 52 is the one that's
right.
used.
Okay.
John Crisco, who's actually involved in the show, he writes us, the show's like two parts, the first being review and collaborator recollections. The second half is about the three interpretations, and it's a bold choice. I love how you let the interviews breathe. And he's very complimentary, too. He loved it. So, all right. So overwhelmingly positive, but we did get some negative feedback.
Yeah.
Okay. Let's see what this is. I'm not going to read it every letter, but... All right, got an email from Comida. That was a mistake-ridden podcast. Blake Moore Cox and Keith Ulick. None of these writers had the slightest idea what the hell is going on in The Shining. And the announcer, whoever he was, spouted continually error-ridden and sloppily told narratives. You didn't even ask Garrett Brown how he came to be the operator, which we did, and he answered it in the show. Did you ask him about all the Concorde flights he took?
Whoa.
We did. I mean, and if you listen to the uncut interview, you'll hear that. Garrett Brown took a Concorde from the States to England for a long time, and it was a trying shoot for him. But that section was not crucial to the narrative of the show. So I'm sorry we left out the part where he, took an airplane back and forth.
Right.
Weak job, and giving the moon landing clown so much time means you don't really know what's inside and how it works. And then he writes back, essentially saying that searching for hidden messages is a weird route to take when examining a thinker like Kubrick. I think it's the perfect route to take.
Mm-hmm.
That's like, he says, I'm putting somebody like the moon landing in there, the moon conspiracy guy. It's like doing a show about the Mona Lisa and offering the Da Vinci Code as a doorway. Don't you see how infinitely idiotic that is? No, but I see how idiotic you are. And he goes on and on and on. He says, stop selling garbage. And, you know, I would be, if this letter were, like, phrased differently, if it were phrased like, these are my thoughts, this is why I think your theories are wrong, and it was inviting some kind of conversation, that would be so incredible, because I could learn from everybody about this film. But what we do invites so much arrogance from people. Like, I am the only person that knows what this film is about. I am the only one with a valid opinion on this film. Our show on The Shining was like the opposite of that. It was inviting as many opinions on this film as we possibly could.
Right.
And so how can you communicate with somebody like that? I have no tolerance for that.
Right, exactly. No, I agree with you.
And I mean, I told him, I can't wait to hear your podcast on The Shining, because all of these guys, they won't make their own thing about The Shining. I mean, that would require them to put their money where their mouth is.
Mm-hmm.
They won't do that. Well, what really upset me is then they found one of our guests, Keith Ulick, and they sent him a hateful email. And I won't read it, but I mean, it's just hateful. So, I mean, that's the kind of stuff that we invite when we do something like
why,
that.
Why go? I don't understand. Why go after Keith? Good guy.
Because,
I mean.
Well, I mean, they had a big problem with his reading on Halloran and what the movie has to say about blackness and about racism and why the paintings are in Halloran's bedroom. And they said, you idiot, essentially. I mean, they were very, like, very threatening and coarse. They're like, it completely mirrors the very next scene where the two naked women, the young woman and the old woman.
Right.
Even if that's true, I mean, what does that mean? I mean, what are you telling me? What does it mean? Okay, it mirrors the two women. All right, and is just for giggles? It does, or is there a purpose behind it?
Yeah, I mean,
and the fact of the matter is, if they cut down that negative tone, and they just accept that, you know what, movies are should be open to all of us, and we could learn from other people's readings of films. If they just took that tone, it could be a very productive exchange. But there's a holier-than-thou kind of arrogance. I own the truth feeling. That,
yeah. I see. No, I don't think any of us can really handle that. That's just BS. I mean, no, come on.
Yeah. So I wrote Keith back, and I said, look, man, we love you. Actually, our audience loves you. They talk,
yeah,
they
I
talk
mean,
about liking
Keith
you
does
all the
so
time.
Much. I mean, Keith, this isn't the first time Keith has been through this, but I mean, you know, that was a lot of BS too, because that was just talk about
Received death threats for a negative review he wrote on The Dark Knight.
Yeah, I mean, people grow up, really.
And it is the same mentality.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, one's more extreme than the other, but it comes from the same place.
Yeah. Mhm. It's ridiculous. Yeah. It's just really people have nothing better to do with. I mean, it's just really just silly, pure silliness. Really, people. What is it? What is that like? Hyman Roth, God, other two people acting that way with guns. I mean, you know.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
It reminds me of that. I'm sorry.
Yeah. So anyway, the bottom line is, we appreciate any response, whether it's negative or positive. But it doesn't bother me if you don't like something we do on the show. Talk to me about it. I mean, just but cut down on the negative tone.
Yeah, that's the whole thing. It's
give
all
us
right
credit that we tried.
It's fine to disagree, but don't – it's not like life and death. Don't get all nasty about it, because that's the thing that no one – you know, it just doesn't make it a fun thing. Once you bring in all that nastiness to it, that negative energy, who the hell wants to
– Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, come
and
on.
Plus, I think if somebody did a podcast about The Shining and they said, this is what The Shining means, that podcast is nowhere near as valuable as a podcast that gives you 15 different voices on what The Shining means. I'm sorry, it just isn't.
Yeah, you're. I agree with you. You're absolutely right.
All right, so I've defended us.
Yeah.
I've defended us in front of, you know, an audience of many, many, many people.
Right.
Okay, let's get to our first interview. What an introduction for that one, huh?
Yeah, wow.
Well, our first interview, Joshua Leonard, Blair Witch Project, and a lot of great movies since then, including Hump Day from last year that I really liked. But
that
one's called
one.
This one's called The Lie. It opens up Friday. He and Jess Wexler play a married couple, young. They had dreams, and then they find themselves burdened with a baby. And they kind of reevaluate their placement in life, and a whole set of character developments occur when his character tells a lie to get out of work that his baby has died. And the comedy and self-reflection and a lot of truth comes out of that lie. It's a really good movie, and it reminds you of the kinds of movies that weren't necessarily obsessed with you liking a character 100%. The characters don't ingratiate themselves to you. It's
right.
It's an honest look at relationships and a certain stage you reach in your life where you're wondering where you're going. So that opens up in limited release on Friday in New York, and I'm sure it will expand in the weeks following. Here is Joshua Leonard talking about his new movie and a whole lot more.
What's going on?
I've been pretty depressed recently.
What is it that you do exactly?
I'm a musician.
You got gigs coming up soon?
Nothing in the immediate future. Kind of anxious, joyless.
Remember, we need organic baby diapers.
I don't really like my job.
Greenix, you bet. Greenix, you bet.
Hey, what's up?
Can everybody, I'm an old prick.
I didn't tell anybody that you were an old prick.
How many old pricks work here? Watch it.
Hi, Radko, it's Lonnie. I don't think I'm going to be able to make it in today.
Oh, God, not again. Not again. Why? Why you can't come to me?
Please just stop yelling at me.
If you ain't everyone, then you're fired.
Radko?
What?
Radko, my daughter died last night.
We just heard the news about Vanna.
It's Patrick. I just heard the news about the baby.
It's okay, baby. Daddy loves you.
How's your day?
Usual.
You. Usual.
I'm sorry, but we got memorial stuff. We gotta send out some like e-bites.
E-bites?
I baked you this quiche. You doing okay?
Hey. Oh, that's so sweet, babe. I got this.
Do you know a three-letter word for distance? Starts with an F.
R? This isn't the life that we wanted.
If you want your life to change, you need to be honest with yourself and your wife.
The music sucks.
Yeah, the music sucks.
We're allowed to change things, right?
I just have this perfect vision, you know, of us.
I've got to tell you something.
First, let me congratulate you. I know you've directed a short and done some co-directing on a doc, but congratulations on your first feature narrative film.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much. I can't believe how long it actually takes when you got to do it yourself.
Yeah. Well, I'm curious about that. In that, I mean, was this just a natural progression?
Well, I hope so. In terms of, you know, in terms of my personal growth as a filmmaker, it's definitely a natural progression. Whether it's a progression in the right direction or not, we'll let the audience decide. But The Lie came about as a result of, you know, my producing partner who I did The Lie with, Mary Pat, and I had another project that was a little bigger that, you know, was about to get made for about 2 years. And I really just, you know, I don't have a lot of tolerance for my friends who sit around talking about doing something for years and years and don't do it. And I kind of had to point that, point the magnifying glass back at myself and realize that, you know, I'd been talking about making a feature film for a while and just wasn't doing it. And, you know, and that kind of got me off my ass. And fortuitously, I wound up reading this T.C. Boyle story in The New Yorker within a week or two of when I really had that crisis of conscience and fell in love with the story. And I'm not a guy who gets a lot of great ideas, so when I do get one that I really believe in, I kind of hold on to it like a dog with bone. And I sent it out to you know, my collaborators on the project, Jess Weitzler and Mark Weber and Mary Pat and Ben Kisulke, who was our director of photography, and said, you know, hey, I want to turn this thing into a movie. It was really good timing because I'd worked with some of those folks on this movie called Hump Day that came out in 2009, and we were getting a really positive audience response from that at the time. And the tenor of this film wasn't altogether different. So everybody read the story and said, let's do it. And, you know, we made it at an independent enough scale that we were able to raise the money very quickly. And I think from the time I read the story until we were on set shooting was about 3.5 months. It was very expedited. And at the very least, I don't have to be the guy talking about, you know, being about to make a film anymore, because, you know, I got really lucky. I found material I loved and collaborators that I trusted, and we just went out and made it.
What was it about this novella, this story, that you said, well, you know what, this one I can really get going?
Well, I think it was multifaceted. In terms of the story itself, I think, you know, in the best case scenario, when you know, we read a piece of literature or see a painting or, you know, watch a movie, you know, once in a while we get that feeling that somebody is speaking directly to us. And I got that feeling with this story in TC's writing. I found, you know, I mean, the humor is very dark, but was right up my alley. And, you know, and the conflicts and kind of the existential journey that these characters are on that laid underneath that high concept of the lie were so relatable to me. And, you know, I felt like I was reading about folks in my peer group in a, you know, kind of exaggerated situation.
Right.
And I think that, you know, whereas on one hand there's a self-awareness that, you know, to get to have the kind of crisis that these characters are having, which is ostensibly they're, you know, white people in their mid-30s who are dealing with, you know, trying to balance their former idealism with their present-day responsibilities. Whereas, you know, on one hand, I think culturally we're lucky that we get to have those kinds of problems. It doesn't mean that they're not problems, and not problems that most of the people I know and love can relate to.
Right.
So I think that was part of it. And from a production standpoint, you know, because it was close enough to home, I kind of knew as soon as, you know, I read the story, I said, you know, Jess would be a perfect wife, Mark would be a perfect friend, you know, Jane Addams is the therapist, and Kirk Baltz as my coworker. You know, it was something that was close enough to home that I felt like we had the perfect group of collaborators and settings and locations right around us to make it something that was pretty tenable on an independent scale.
Did you have a mixture of both confidence and a little nervousness on dealing with the balancing act of the tone of the piece? Because it is dramatic, but it, like you said, it's this darkly funny thing. And particularly the lie at the center of it is one of those things that, you know, the audience can really put them on edge because of the nature of the lie. But, you know, it's also the source of the humor. And so that's a tricky balancing act for, you know, a veteran filmmaker. So I'm curious.
Well, yeah, and I think, you know, if you look at Hump Day, it was, you know, both of these films, in terms of the trope, kind of present this very high concept scenario and try to reverse engineer themselves into something that's got a lot more humanity in it. And so I think the experience on that film was very educational for me in terms of the acting and the directing. You know, honestly, man, I because we made it so fast, because, you know, the ethos was so kind of punk rock, and once we started, we just didn't stop. I think I almost had more faith in my ability, having been an actor for 15 years, to go in and try to find that tonal balance than I did in communicating that to another actor who might play the Lonnie role. Because I think part of what I responded to in the story was that whereas Lonnie, I think, can be a very alienating character to lots of people, he was somebody that I really related to. Right. In all his flaws and ugliness and, you know, and confusion, and yet an attempt to redeem himself, you know, it was a character that I found very relatable. You know, I think I also never would have felt the confidence I felt without having been surrounded by collaborators who I trusted absolutely implicitly. You know, knowing Ben, knowing Mary Pat, knowing Jess, knowing Mark, and pretty much, you know, a really good percentage of the cast and the crew were people who I trusted. You know, if I got exhausted beyond the point of objectivity that I could look to and go like, hey, did I suck there? did we get the scene? And, you know, and I just had some of my favorite people watching my back on it.
Yeah, the line whenever an actor also directs himself, the line is usually that, well, at least the director has at least one person who's in total agreement with themselves.
If you knew what went on inside my brain,
yeah,
in the darkest moments, you would not know that was absolutely not the case in this scenario.
And you talk about the actors. I mean, Jane Addams is, you know, terrific, and Mark Webber and Kirk. I mean, Kirk Bulbs. I mean, this is the guy from Reservoir Dogs.
Exactly.
You know, so I mean, so these guys. I mean, I assume, as you said, this must have been. This is one thing needed when actors go into directing, is to have this kind of support system of fellow travelers.
Well, and I think that's, you know, I mean, look, on one hand, I used up my favors for three lifetimes to come trying to get this movie made. But on the other hand, you know, I did get to call those in because, you know, because I've spent many years kind of in the trenches with a lot of these guys. You know, one of the tremendous advantages you get on a film like this is, you know, there are no financing is not cast contingent, and a lot of times that's, you know, as an independent filmmaker trying to get a movie made where you need a little more money, you know, you have those awful sleepless nights where, you know, you want Tom Wilkinson, but you're trying to figure out if Tim Allen could pull off the same role just so you can get the movie made. And we didn't have to do any of that on this. I got to cast exactly who I wanted and was lucky enough that all the folks that I wanted said yes.
And obviously directing, you know, doing a pre-production on a film is one thing. Then actually directing and acting it is another, and putting it together is another phase. So what was it like finally when you saw it with an audience? I mean, because eventually you do have to show it.
Yeah, I mean, it's nerve-wracking. It was absolutely nerve-wracking when I saw it for the first time with an audience. You know, because especially in this film, I had the self-consciousness of my own performance, and then, you know, obviously the larger concern as a director, you know, are they going to get the story? Are they going to care about it? You know, are they going to take the ride with us? And, And you know, it's we've just been met with nothing but love. I wouldn't say nothing but love. Actually, that's an exaggeration. We've been met with a tremendous amount of love and some very mindful hate, which I'll take, you know, any day of the week. You know, it's really interesting. You know, the assessments that I get from people who the film hasn't been for, and I've had as many interesting conversations with them as folks who have really loved the film. And you know, and it's just a dream scenario at some of these Q&As, you know, since we've been on our festival run starting at Sundance, where because we made a film about things that we care about, we get to talk about things that we care about, you know, with the audience and have a very direct dialogue, which is very exciting and I think all we could have hoped for.
Well, and to start wrapping this up, now that you're letting this baby out into the world, are you excited to do it again, or are you wanting to go to just concentrate on acting for a while?
No, I can't wait to make another film, and I would say I'm about 70-30 in terms of 70% of my time being put into developing, you know, the next directing projects. I really loved doing it. I can't wait to do it again. As I said, I can't wait to do it without being on both sides of the camera. Mm-hmm. It takes a lot of the fun away when you can't wear a baseball cap and gain 20 pounds. You know, I aspire to get to just, you know, really, really step back and work with a group of collaborators just as a director. And on the other hand, you know, I've learned probably 90% about what I know as a director from working with other directors as an actor. So, you know, I don't think I'll ever give that up, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Feet the fire, if I had to pick one, I'd probably go directing, but fortunately we have free will. So I don't expect that ultimatum to come up anytime soon.
That's true. Well, and also you've had the pleasure, the luck to work with other actor turned directors, and I'm thinking of the great work you did in A Higher Ground.
Oh, thank you so much. Yeah, and that is a perfect example. I Vera Farmiga was, you know, she was, I mean, she had me beat because she was acting, directing, and 5 months pregnant at the time. So I lose that battle hands down. But she was also one of the best directors I've ever worked with.
Right.
And I went, you know, straight from the lie to working with her on Higher Ground, and, you know, kind of had a more intimate vantage point as to what she might be going through. And I think when it works, it really works. And, you know, the difference between acting and directing is I walked onto her movie. We had 15 or 20 conversations before the movie started. I worked with her for, you know, 6 weeks on set in upstate New York. And then I didn't have to do anything else until I was sitting in the seat at Sundance watching our premiere.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, much like I'd been kind of back in the dark basements trying to get the life put together, she's been doing the same thing with Higher Ground. So there's also a tremendous amount of freedom to just being an actor and, you know, kind of going in, giving it your best, and then really letting it go, because it's not your job to see it through to the end.
Right. Well, before I let you go, I mean, we are Movie Geeks United, so I would be crucified if I didn't ask you one geeky question. But I'll keep
Please.
It painless. I'll keep it relatively painless. My question has always been involving Blair Witch, is that how long after Blair Witch did you finally go camping on your own again?
You know what, Ben? I don't know that I have been camping since Blair Witch.
Okay.
How awful is that?
Well, you have a good excuse.
I've been living between New York and LA, so, you know, there's not a lot of great camping, but
Well, you have a good excuse.
I think that experience might have really soured me on the camping. Maybe I'll do it again when I have kids.
Yeah. No. But like I said, that's a good excuse not to go camping. Like, why don't you? Well, I was in Blair Witch. Like, oh. Well,
exactly.
It's a good excuse not to go camping. So,
exactly.
How long was it after that? Were you able to, like, after that phenomenon, that summer of 99, which everyone remembers, how long was it after that that you were finally able to have a good amount of distance from it, where it wasn't, you had, you know, other things became part of your life and your career, and it wasn't just, oh, I was one of the three in the Blair Witch? How long did that take?
I mean, I would say honestly, I mean the tricky thing about human psychology is we are such adaptable creatures that you feel like you've got perspective on it right after it happens, and then you realize later that you actually had no perspective on it. So looking back now, I would say it probably took 5 or 6 years until I had any objective perspective on what had happened, because it was so unanticipated. I was so young at the time, and it was really all consuming. And in terms of, you know, in terms of public perception, and look, if you look at that film for what we made it as and not what it became, I'm still damn proud of that film, because it is as independent as anything I've ever done. And, it just happened to strike a chord. And I think a lot of that was right place, right time.
Mm-hmm.
So I think because of that, you know, I've never had any real chip on my shoulder about being the guy from Blair Witch.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I mean, look, I think maybe I've done 2 interviews in my life where it hasn't come up as at least a sidebar.
Right.
So it'll always be that to some extent. But certainly as of the last, as of the last half decade or so, I have felt less like it defines me, at least personally. And much more kind of entrenched in my own endeavors.
Okay, that's Joshua Leonard, actor and now director, with his new film, The Lie, opens up in New York on Friday. It's a good movie. Check it out.
That sounds cool. Sounds very interesting.
Thank you for Aaron. To Aaron Adadiaz, yeah, our home entertainment correspondent, for doing that interview for us. Okay, big Oscar news this past week. There's been a lot of kind of shakeups.
Yeah, that's one way of looking at it, yeah.
So to recap, I guess, since we haven't, this all went down when we were off the air. They hired Brett Ratner to produce the Oscar telecast. He, in turn, brought in Eddie Murphy to host it. There's a lot of buzz about Eddie Murphy, and this is a big comeback following Tower Heist.
Mm-hmm.
And people were anxious to see him as host. Brett Ratner, as he tends to do, as he did on our show, he put his foot in his mouth, I guess. He made a statement that a lot of people found homophobic, and then he went on Howard Stern and talked very frankly about his sexual escapades with certain actresses.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Which, you know, I mean, he's going on Howard Stern.
Yeah, I mean, you don't really expect he ain't going to be like the Vienna Boys Choir, you know?
I mean, yeah. And I watched the Howard Stern interview, and you know, the mistake was that he went on Howard Stern. I mean, you can't really blame Howard Stern about that.
Right.
But, I mean, if he was trying to watch his image, I mean, that was the last place he needed to be honest.
True.
In an interview.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, they fired Brett Ratner. Eddie Murphy, in turn, dropped out hours later, or the next morning. And then hours later, they announced Brian Grazer as the new producer and Billy Crystal returning as host.
Right.
My feeling is that all this went down, they were probably ready to fire Brett Ratner over the weekend, because I think all this went down on a Tuesday or Wednesday last
week. Right, yeah.
I think they had their contingency plan over the weekend, because there's no way in 3 hours after Murphy drops out that they all of a sudden get a producer and a host again. I think they knew what was going down.
I think you're right.
So first thing, was Eddie, were they right to drop Brett Ratner?
I think it wasn't using Brett Ratner was the hope was to finally get younger viewers. That was the hope or something, that he would gear the show younger, and getting that demographic they seem never to have gotten. I mean, Brett shouldn't have said the things he said, but I thought it was kind of stupid to get rid of him. And then, but the thing is, Eddie Murphy hosting, that would have been a huge, huge thing for him.
Yeah.
And it would have been just a curiosity to see him of all the, he's the last person I would have thought of. Never would have picked him.
Yeah.
And I would have been very curious. Have you read the Rolling Stone interview with him?
I haven't, just highlights.
I think you should read it. It is a fascinating interview because, first of all, I've just never seen in Rolling Stone a man curse so much in an interview. not in a bad way, in a very funny way. There's something very human about it. But it's actually a very good interview, a very honest interview. And after reading that, I was really kind of disappointed he wasn't hosting, because I actually did. I thought when he enters Tower Heist, it actually is a very interesting movie. It's a fun movie. It's not a great movie, but it's a fun movie. But it was nice to see him in something where it wasn't a family film geared towards like the 8 and under crowd.
Where you feel like he's muting his attitude.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean it was a good role. I mean, that and Dreamgirls, I really liked him in. And but this is the first good comedy he's made in a very, very, very long time.
You know
what
though?
Great, but it still was it was enjoyable for like the end of the week or something. Yeah.
I mean, no one has shortchanged his career other than him.
Right.
I mean, he's kind of sabotaged his own career.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it has a lot to do with his arrogance.
Oh, see, there's a lot of that. There's definitely a lot of that.
Because, I mean, they even had to twist his arm to be in something of quality like Dreamgirls.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so part of me, I don't care if Brett Ratner, producer or not producer, it never mattered to me.
Right.
And honestly, I think some of the worst Oscar telecasts are the ones that are produced by people that actually make films, which is odd, but it would be a natural.
It's a totally different beat.
Yeah. It needs to be someone that knows television, mm-hmm. and even more than that, knows the stage, knows the theatrical experience. So that didn't bother me. But Eddie Murphy's decision, it's just yet another thing that sours me on him.
Yeah.
Because it seems to be saying, look, I didn't really care about hosting the Oscars. I just wanted to work with Brett Ratner again.
Right. Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's what his decision says. Absolutely. Right. I mean, there's no other way to really look at it.
Right.
Because Brian Grazer has worked with Eddie Murphy before. Eddie Murphy, I'm sure if he wanted to do the Oscars, if that was his primary goal, he could have sat down with the people, with the Academy. They could have worked out something, an arrangement for a producer. They probably would have brought in any kind of producer that he felt most comfortable with.
Right.
That being said, I mean, Billy Crystal is the old reliable. I don't know anyone that's – I think the thing about Billy Crystal hosting now is now you know exactly the Oscars you're going to get.
Yeah. The no surprises.
Yeah.
No surprises.
But there's comfort in that.
There is comfort with Billy Crystal because he's the only person alive – who can do, I think we can all agree, who can do a good job.
Yeah.
And who has done a good job. I mean, he's the only person I think that can really bring it home in that regard.
Right. So, I don't know, skew younger. I know that was just thought with Brett Ratner.
It depends what's nominated, too.
Yeah.
If
the black and white silent movie is going to win every award, it ain't going to skew younger.
Yeah, you're not skewing younger. Even if something like the Descendants, or the only thing I can think, even the Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, I don't see any of these really.
Yeah.
I just don't. I mean, I really just don't see it happening.
You nominate Harry Potter in every category.
Now
that's a younger audience.
An interesting thing. Would they not? I actually bought two Blu-rays recently: the Blue Velvet and the last Harry Potter film. Or the first Blu-rays I've bought in a long time, and I'm curious. Do you think they would do what they did with Lord of the Return of the King and nominate it?
I think it could get a Best Picture. Maybe
I think it deserves it, but because I think it is a monumental achievement. Most movies go downhill with each, you know, as each installment goes on. This one is that rare thing where it builds up, and it has to build up, and the payoff, and there is a huge payoff at the end. It does, it works. I mean, it's, if you go through the whole thing, and if you've been patient, I think you're very well rewarded. But I also think it's very good storytelling.
There's also this about Brett Ratner. So he admits that he loves having sexual relations with supermodels.
Right, okay.
To be
we're
sensitive.
Back to the government.
I mean,
Harry Potter to this.
I mean, he goes further than that, more graphic than that.
Right.
But that's essentially what he's saying. So, in a way, them firing Brett Ratner for this, doesn't it make them seem even more stodgy? Even more, like, old and stodgy and grumpy, the Academy?
Yeah, it does. It is something very... Yeah, the Emmys...
Puritanical.
Yeah, the Emmys and the Tonys seem to have a lot of fun. They seem to know what to do. And the Oscars, for some reason, is like stuck and frozen in time almost.
Mm-hmm. I don't know. And how many people really tune in because of the host, asks Michaela. I guess it's Michaela. In the chat room.
Dave Letterman?
Does it make a difference? I'm of two minds about this, because I think people will initially tune in to see how the host does at the opening monologue. But as the evening wears on, the host's role becomes less and less relevant.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, really, it's just really all about them going on and making an impression right off the bat, setting the energy, and then it really doesn't matter what they do.
Right.
I know they come in occasionally, but... It's kind of irrelevant.
Or they don't really care. They tune out. That's James Franco.
Michaela. Michaela. Thank you, Michaela.
Thank you, Michaela.
I won't do it. So I don't know. And I don't know how much a host really matters.
Well,
I mean...
Someone like Jon Stewart. Everyone was very excited about Jon Stewart. And the thing with Jon Stewart is, while he was very funny and everything... they don't like it when you make jokes at their expense. That was a big lesson. Or Chris Rock, who had a field day with Jude Law. And
What do you want to bring a comedian on for? But you have to have a comedian.
Yeah.
I mean, if last year proved anything, it was that.
Mm-hmm.
I think Hugh Jackman did a great job.
Hugh Jackman, I would welcome back. I think he could do it.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah. I don't know. Oscar Schmoskers. So J. Edgar, after seeing J. Edgar, do you still think it has Oscar possibilities?
I think DiCaprio might have Oscar possibilities. I think even Armie Hammer might. But it's an odd film. There's something so... is there something... These guys seem to make, and I love Eastwood, but I think it doesn't work, because it's such a traditional biopic that they could have had some real fun with this. I almost think they should have made it a musical at the rate they were going. parts of it, but no, really. Doesn't it seem stale in places? Just like, I mean. His performance is good, and I agree with you. The scenes with him and Armie Hammer are probably the best scenes, the best parts of the movie, actually. I just think there's something almost, it's like a paint-by-numbers biopic, almost.
Mm.
Now, let me ask you this. Did you think it was heavy-handed at times?
Heavy-handed. Well,
let me ask you this. Did you like it?
Largely, I did. I mean, I give it kind of a 7 out of 10.
Yeah, that's how I'm... I mean...
What surprised me about it was what it was. I mean, there's definitely some areas you can criticize it for what it wasn't.
Right.
Like what pieces of history it chooses to avoid. And
right.
That kind of thing. But what it is a movie about an enduring love between two men.
Mm-hmm.
That's what J. Edgar is at its heart. And that surprised me out of Clint Eastwood.
Mm-hmm.
And it surprises me that the Eastwood movie this most closely resembles is Bridges of Madison County.
There's a lot of truth in that. There's a lot.
In the tenderness of it. Mm-hmm. So that's the part that moved me. And I was moved by the film, and I was moved by the relationship between DiCaprio and Hammer.
Mm-hmm. I think that's the heart and soul of the film. I mean, that's really...
Yeah.
Without that, I don't think you have anything. I mean...
The movie doesn't make history very exciting.
Now, that's the thing that I think you hit it right on the head. There's something... It's almost very deflating of all these important events, and... I think it's an odd film. I don't think it's an awful film by any stretch of the imagination. I just think the spark is missing from most of it, I think.
There's no propulsion to it. There's very little kind of energy. The cinematography is so drab, and
mm-hmm.
and it doesn't differ at all from era to era.
Mm-hmm.
There's just one look, and it's drab. And part of me thinks, is that because of the makeup? Does the makeup look better when it's shot with such drab lighting?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. Maybe it was a practical decision.
Yeah.
And imagine if Oliver Stone had directed this.
Oh, my God.
The history in it, the incendiary aspects of his life would be heightened and operatic.
Mm-hmm.
But you would lose the very kind of subtle, deeply felt kind of tenderness of the central story.
Yeah. I kept thinking of Nixon while watching.
Yeah.
You can't
yeah.
help but not think of Nixon. Not just because Bob Hoskins played Hoover in that, but just if there is, it owes, it actually does owe something to Nixon, I think. Or maybe it's just the same time periods in a way. But I couldn't get Nixon, the other, obviously The Aviator at times, because of DiCaprio. I couldn't get that out of my mind either. So,
yeah,
it's an interesting film. I think I'm glad I saw it. I mean, I don't regret watching it, not at all.
I think where the film fails is in Eastwood's lackadaisical approach.
Yeah,
I think that shows sometimes,
mm-hmm.
and I think it shows in this movie.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I admire his ambition in terms of the subjects of the films he chooses
mm-hmm.
to
yeah.
tackle. Now, he just doesn't really. You don't get a sense that he grapples with things.
One or two takes and then move on? I mean...
Yeah. Even in the screenplay phase, he doesn't grapple with it. He says, well, that's fine, let's shoot it. I mean, he doesn't necessarily... There's no urgency in anything he does, really. I mean, you don't get a sense of urgency in anything. Maybe Invictus. I mean, but I don't even look at Invictus as a great... sports movie. I still don't understand what the hell they're playing. I don't understand that game, whatever they're
rugby,
playing.
Rugby.
Yeah. I don't know what they're doing on that field. But but there's a heart in Invictus. That
yes, there play. Is. Mm-hmm.
But DiCaprio is amazing in it.
Mm-hmm.
And
I'd be surprised if he doesn't get nominated. But
yeah.
it's going to be a tight field, I think, this year.
If he doesn't get nominated, that's why. Because
yeah.
there's a lot to choose from.
Mm-hmm.
Look, the DP, Tom Stern, is terrific. I like him.
Mm-hmm.
But the movie looks dull and drab.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it probably has the same look as The Changeling. I mean, it's
I
just
forgetting
like a,
about that, yeah. It has
like
the same pacing as The Changeling, too. The pacing gets better as it moves on, though. I mean, but there are similarities between the two.
I mean, you're making a movie that spans 50 years of history, and you only give it one look.
Yeah.
You know, there's no delineation
at
all.
That's a very good observation.
Yeah. Maybe you could relate that to the character. I mean, the character refuses to change in spite of the changing times, and that's his downfall.
Yeah.
I mean, you
mm-hmm.
could make a motivational argument for having the same look.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But, you know. Jack and Jill.
Well, let's hear all about Jack and Jill.
Look, everyone knows that I'm insanely crazy about Pacino.
If Pacino wasn't in it, would you have busted your ass?
Oh, no.
Okay.
This is an awful movie.
Okay.
I don't know if it's any more or less awful than any other Adam Sandler comedies of its ilk, like Little Nicky or like Grown Ups.
Well, it seems like the last couple of years, especially the last couple of years, where basically his movies are I Have to Give My Friends Work, really should be the category they fall into.
Yeah.
There's this really, this fake, really phony sentimentality with family and everything that's just like so, and I don't mind that, but it's so phony, you just want to throw up. I mean.
Well, it goes without saying that Al Pacino is the best thing about the movie, but let me tell you, the movie kind of runs out of ideas of what to do with Pacino near the end of it, but he is hysterical. Someone needs to write him a comedy. And there's one scene in this movie that is so incredibly classic. I mean, I could watch this scene forever. It's the funniest single
okay.
scene I've seen.
Tell us what it is.
Pacino is on stage doing Richard III.
Oh, God.
And in front of a full audience and the cast on stage with him. And his cell phone rings, and he accepts the call in the middle of the show because it's Adam Sandler calling him to tell him his chances with the cross-dressing Adam Sandler, the sister, the identical sister. Pacino's in love with the sister. So he's like, he answers the call in the middle of the performance. That's how committed he is to this woman. And he's having this conversation. He says, no, and Sandler's like, I don't think it's going to happen with my sister. He says, no, I'm not going to take that for an answer. And then the audience is like, what's going on? And they're upset. And then Pacino starts to quote The Godfather. And he's like, don't you know I would never let that happen? Don't you know? I would do everything in my power. And someone in the audience is like, he's quoting The Godfather. He's pulling out The Godfather. And then the audience starts erupting into applause. And then the stand-in walks out for Pacino and says, Al, do you want me to go on? He's like, no, nobody paid to see you. I mean, it's this hysterical scene. And then he has a closing scene that has to be seen to be believed, where he's dancing and rapping in a Dunkin' Donuts commercial. Part of the reason why he's very funny in the movie is because he has no shame. And if you think of, like, funny comedic performances,
mm-hmm.
like, say like Will Ferrell on Saturday Night Live, he was funny in those sketches because he had absolutely no shame.
Right.
Yeah, you can't be timid and go for that kind of comedy.
No, of course, you're right. Absolutely right.
So Pacino's best scenes, I'm sure they're going to go viral. They'll be online, probably on YouTube as little individual clips, and you can see him from there. But, I mean, the movie's not worth your time.
Okay, all right.
Well, did you see, there was something on last night on TCM of John Williams and Steven Spielberg together?
No, but what was it? It was about, like, I guess the court... coincide with War Horse, or
yeah, it's about their history of collaborating together
cool.
for the past 40 years. It was kind of like they were talking amongst themselves into a class at the AFI Conservatory
mm-hmm.
For an hour, and they were going through, you know, their favorite cues and their favorite melding of music and film, both from their own collaborations and from others. And it was fascinating. 40 years they've collaborated. He's only broken away from Williams once, right?
I think
Color
you're
Purple,
right?
Right?
I think so.
He's used Williams for everything else.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah. And just a collage of mm-hmm. great music. Obviously.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's a lot of... Like I said, I definitely will be buying the War Horse score. Definitely.
And Williams doesn't watch movies. I mean, he scores enough of them, so
right.
I'm sure he watches, you know, quite a few in a given year because he scores so many of them. But he doesn't go out and watch movies.
Well, he's busy. He's always not a
moviegoer.
Right.
And he said, look, when he tried to pick his favorite examples of music and film together, he said, I can't remember the scenes, but I can remember the music. So he said, just pick whatever scene this scores from, you know, because he's not a movie.
Right.
Fanatic, yeah. It's always interesting to me, people that work in films and dedicate their lives
right.
to them that aren't movie fanatics necessarily.
And he is such an integral part of what made Spielberg's films and also obviously Star Wars. I mean, he is really the music, the sound.
Superman.
I mean, all these
iconic
things.
Iconic all the way.
Yeah, I mean, he's really the key.
Yeah.
I mean, he really, I mean, those are the things that the music from those films is I think will live on forever. But, wow.
And it also, I mean, it also, the more popular you become and the more influential you become, the more people kind of criticize you. So the criticism against John Williams is the bombast and what's a score supposed to do? Is it supposed to tell you how to feel?
Mm-hmm.
Or underscore whatever's going on in the scene. And a lot of the criticisms against John Williams is that he overscores it.
Yeah, I've heard that too. I think that's bunk. I really do.
Yeah.
I mean, some people say the same about Hans Zimmer and the Inception or the Batman scores. I think they're just incredible. I think very key part of those films is the music.
I never feel like his music drowns out watching. I feel like it elevates it.
Yeah, because there's a great thing when Return of the Jedi came out in 2020, they interviewed John Williams, and they showed a scene without the music and with the music, and the difference is astronomical. I mean, it's just incredible just what he brings to it. So I don't agree with that at all. I think he's a key part, a key player in the movie process.
Yeah. Me too. Here is their latest collaboration.
Oh, God, I can't wait to hear. I'm probably going to burst out into tears listening to this. I know the story. The trailer, dude, you cannot go to the movie with me when this trailer's on because it's very emotional.
Yeah.
It's a very emotional trailer.
I've read reviews that say it's very much Spielbergian.
Oh, yeah. It has all those hallmarks right there.
Yeah. And it's way sentimental,
mm-hmm.
which might be its detriment in terms of Oscars.
Might
maybe.
Be its detriment, but I think it would be. We haven't seen that kind of film. We've seen a lot
yeah.
of good movies from Spielberg, but we haven't seen this kind of movie from
yeah.
Spielberg in a
yeah.
while. And I think that might be very welcome right now.
I think so too.
Yeah,
yeah. And also I hear the Tintin is a great action movie in the vein of Raiders of the Lost Ark. They say that Tintin might be too action-packed and breathless for its own good.
Mm. Wow.
Yeah. And then I see Hugo on Monday.
Hugo looks fascinating.
Yeah. Look, Hugo. All right.
Let's hear it.
Here's a little piece of film score from War Horse, the latest collaboration between Steven Spielberg and John Williams. I believe this movie opens up
Christmas Day.
Okay.
Yeah, yes.
All right, here it is, guys. Okay, that's the opening theme from War Horse from John Williams. Mm-hmm. Gives you a little taste of what to expect from
the
film.
Yeah. Who's doing this? Is Howard Shore is doing it for Hugo, right?
Yeah, and it's different
okay.
for him. It's
okay.
a different kind of score for him. Mm-hmm. I was going to play that tonight, but I have it in the wrong file format. Mm-hmm. I can't convert it to a different file. I didn't have a chance to do that. I've got, let's see, what do I have on my switchboard? I have the Artist film score,
mm-hmm.
The Descendants, A Dangerous Method. We'll play that on Sunday.
Okay.
Fireflies in the Garden, Rum Diary, Tower Heist.
Wow.
And Knight Rider.
Knight Rider, yes. Knight Rider.
There you go.
Don't you have the music from Dune?
Doesn't this sound exactly like classic John Williams?
Yes, it does.
I did have the soundtrack to Dune, but
that
I deleted
was
it.
Great. Whenever you,
I think we played that out.
Yeah, but that was just so funny, though. That whole show was surreal.
Yeah. For all of those people out there that are interested, I think the Christopher Lee Gallery opening went fantastically well. 150
awesome.
Christopher Lee paintings. I don't know if a single one was sold.
That was insane. I'm sorry. It just is so the way Dean kept talking about it. It's just 150 paintings.
The most surreal conversation
yeah,
I think I've ever
hilarious.
Had. I wake up in the morning and I go outside and I'm faced with 150 paintings of Christopher Lee. Wow.
Yep.
Also, something that's happened putting together the Shining show for the past month, I've been hearing these sound clips over and over and over again.
Right.
And Scatman Crothers cracks me up. Hearing him say, like, walk down the hall and be like, hello? Anybody here? Hello? And, I mean, I think he was our finest bow-legged actor.
That's
that
funny.
Man was bow-legged. I mean, oh, dear God. All right. Anyway, anything else? What's out this weekend that you're checking out?
I think the big thing, well, obviously there's the Twilight movie, the beginning of the end, if you will. But the other thing is the Descendants opens here. We're going to try to go see that if we can get in.
Oh, that's not that opens this weekend for you?
Yeah. It supposedly got a fantastic review in the New York Times today. It opens, I think, in New York and L.A. today, but then it opens a couple more places on Friday. But, you know, speaking of Best Actor, I think it's for...
Oh, yeah.
This movie will be for Clooney the best chance recently. We haven't talked about The Ides of March. And as much as I love Ryan Gosling... This is kind of, for me, a disappointment. I don't know, just something, it fizzles for some reason.
Right.
But I got to give Clooney props for directing what he believes in. But it just, I don't know, it just fizzled for me for some reason. I know it's done well, actually it's done surprisingly well, given the subject matter. But it just didn't work for me. And it's hard with Gosling because he's made these two back-to-back powerhouse movies, Crazy Stupid Love and especially Drive, and it's just, I don't know. I'd be curious to hear what other people, I don't know if anyone else has seen Ides of March, I'd be curious what other people have to say, but I don't know, it just didn't, like the first half is really good, and then the second half it just peters off.
I haven't checked it out yet, but I intend to.
It's definitely worth checking out, I mean, definitely.
Join us on Twitter at twitter.com/moviegeeksunite because we post a lot of movie news and a lot of material there every day. We've really upped our presence on Twitter.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I mean, we're talking like about 20 or 30 movie news tweets a day.
Right. No, yeah, no, it's very impressive.
Some news headlines on there lately. Andy Serkis getting 7 figures to come back on another Planet of the Apes sequel. What else? I'm looking at it right now.
That's actually really interesting because that'd be so that movie really, really surprised me how well done it was. I know we talked about that when we were doing the remakes of movies that we thought would be should be remade. But it's just incredible how that movie really, that and the X-Men movie really, like, followed the great traditions that they've done with the Bond and the Batman films and really reinvented them in such unique ways. I really have to say, what I really liked about the Planet of the Apes movies is you did not have to see any of the previous films to enjoy that. If you did, it's a bonus because you get to some of the little, like, the Easter eggs in the film, a little, you know, there's a lot of it, some in jokes. But you could walk into that cold and still, I think, enjoy it.
Yeah, I haven't watched it yet.
Okay, so I'm just saying that, but it's good.
I'm another person that doesn't like movies. I like movies, but I don't like them.
No, but speaking of that, there was a very good interview in the Polk County Democrat. That was a very good interview.
Oh, thank you, dude.
Yeah, you didn't bring that up, man. I thought you'd bring it up in the start of the show, but no, it's really, we have it linked on all our pages, but you should check it out. It's a really good interview, guys.
You guys will hear how we put the show together, like what it entails and stuff. So.
Right.
Movie Geeks United on Facebook. That's our Facebook fan page, too, if you're on there. Iron Lady, Meryl Streep's new movie, getting good reviews. They say the performance way outclasses the movie, which I would expect. Which I thought that would probably be the case.
Right, yeah.
But Meryl Streep, definite front runner, I'm sure. Brad Pitt hinting that he's going to quit acting when he turns 50, which is right around the corner.
Really?
That would be
a shame.
How old
is Brad? How old?
I think he's at least mid-40s, I would think. I don't know. I'm sure if they adopt a couple more kids, he'll want to leave the house occasionally. And so I don't think that we'll be without Brad Pitt as an actor for very long. Doctor Who, they're making a movie out of Doctor Who. Harry Potter director David Yates is going to do it.
Oh, that should be very good.
The initial cut of Girl with a Dragon Tattoo runs 3 hours in length. I mean, hell, the initial cut of the trailer runs 3 hours in length.
So is he going to cut that, or?
I don't know.
I hope he doesn't. I actually kind of hope he doesn't, but I know they need people to go see it, so.
They asked him if they think, they asked Fincher if he thinks that Dragon Tattoo will get Oscar nominations, and he says no, there's far too much anal rape in the movie, too.
Yeah, I read that, too, but,
I think he's self-deprecating when it comes to the Oscars.
Yeah, I think you got to remember Daniel Craig a couple months saw parts of the movie and he said it's the most adult thing that he's ever been involved with, and so I'd be very curious to. I think it will get nominations. I really do. I think he is being too self-deprecating.
I think it will too. Sacha Baron Cohen, he's in, of course, Hugo. Scorsese's movie, and he also just took a role in Tarantino's Django Unchained.
Do we know what part he has in Django? Do we know anything about
that? No, don't think we know that yet.
Okay, I'd be curious to see what part he's playing. It's a great cast so far.
A key role, apparently.
Yeah.
Warren Beatty's new movie, man. I mean, look, Warren Beatty hasn't made a movie since what? Town and Country?
Yep.
96 or whatever
right.
it was? I don't know when that movie was. It could have been the early 2000s. Who knows? I mean, who saw it? But he is the control freaks, the most controlling of control freaks.
Mm-hmm.
And it apparently is a nightmare to work for him. So he gets back in the fray. He's directing his first movie in years and years and years and years, directing, writing, producing, starring. Howard Hughes, the latter part of his life, concerning a beautiful young woman that falls in love with a driver or someone that works for Howard Hughes
mm-hmm.
and ends up having an affair with Howard Hughes. He's cast Felicity Jones, who plays the female lead in a new movie called Like Crazy. He cast her as his female lead.
Mm-hmm.
The financial backer, the main financial backer, I think, Morgan Creek, I think it is,
mm-hmm.
has backed out of the movie. And the casting director has quit over creative differences. So, I mean, I already smell, like, his ego taking over the production and kind of already causing problems before
right.
you even start rolling on it. he's a perfectionist, but you know, but just because you're a perfectionist doesn't mean you're perfect.
Exactly.
Akira remake, Kristen Stewart's been offered the female role in that.
They've been trying to get a live-action movie this made forever.
Isn't the Hughes brothers? Aren't the Hughes brothers the ones that were going to do that?
They were at one time. I say just leave it as is, but they, no one ever does. But so I'd be curious. I'm just curious to see it, how this is going to play out. But it's a landmark anime film. I mean, it really is a game changer when it came out. But I just don't. I don't know. I mean, I don't.
What,
they're
what can
having
we say?
So much trouble with it. Trying to get this made. We'll see what happens. But I'm not really expecting anything.
If they get Kristen Stewart, it's going to get made.
Yeah.
Spielberg wants to do an epic Moses film. Star Trek II will be shooting soon.
Now that's good. He didn't rush it, because remember that was supposed to come out the same weekend as Spider-Man. I'm glad they're not rushing it.
Mm-hmm. And we have a link to an article where Wim Wenders discusses the movie and the soundtrack to Until the End of the World, which is a movie he made 20 years ago.
Yeah, that's really funny. That's a very interesting movie.
It's a great soundtrack, too.
No, it's an awesome soundtrack.
I mean, that's a soundtrack. Lou Reed, R.E.M.,
you too.
Katie Lang. Yeah. Good stuff. It's a great soundtrack.
Yeah.
Okay. So go to us, twitter.com/moviegeeksunite, facebook.com/moviegeeksunited to hear all the latest updates on the show and movie news in general, and follow us at moviegeeksunited.net. That's our main website where you can find links to every single one of our interviews, mm-hmm. and the latest information on our Kubrick series is there as well, and uncut interviews. We have seven new uncut interviews from this last installment of the Kubrick series. Now, the Kubrick series included like about 15 interviews kind of edited together to tell one story.
Right.
But each interview lasts about an hour, and we cut that way down for the final shows.
Right.
So you can hear those uncut interviews on our website. So do check that out if you'd like. I mean, we've just given our audience 11 new hours of programming in the past couple of days. So, yeah, we've been gone, but we've been working.
Right, yeah, no, it's great.
Kirk Kenny, a great friend to the show, he directed the documentary film Dear Zachary. If you haven't seen Dear Zachary, check it out. It's available on DVD. Get it, because you'll thank us for it. It's the most moving film you're likely to ever see. His new movie is called Shuffle, and it's a bit different. It's a narrative feature about a man whose life is experienced out of chronological order. And we're going to close the show with our conversation with Kurt Kinney about this new film. It shows at two film festivals upcoming this month, the 20th in St. Louis, the 29th, I believe, in San Diego.
Mm-hmm.
He'll reiterate that information near the end of the interview. Go to shufflethemovie.com for more information about the film. So that's
all right. Cool.
Anything else going on that you want to talk about?
No, I think that's, I mean, everything I can think of right now since the last live show we've done. I mean, we'll have a lot to talk. I'm really curious to hear what Cronenberg will have to say. This movie, the trailer, it's a great trailer. So definitely looking forward to that when that opens.
Yeah, I'm interested in what, I have no idea what to ask him.
Oh, this seems like something like so up his alley, though. These two of the greatest minds,
you know what? I scare myself so much because when I get on the phone with these with these people, like a Cronenberg, I know everyone else would like prepare.
Uh-huh.
But I don't do that anymore. So I get
you
on the phone.
You do an
with
awesome
them.
Job. So I mean,
I get on the phone with
them.
I literally don't know what I'm going to ask.
You always do an awesome job, so don't worry about it.
So it scares the hell out of me, though.
Oh, of course, it's very intimidating, at least from my perspective. Yeah, but
and thank you, Mashila. Mashila says, "Jamie, I like your take on why Kevin Costner left Django Unchained." Thank you.
You know, I like it too. It was a rumor has it part two, right? or wait, no. What was that other one? 3,000 Miles of Graceland, the prequel.
It's, is there a blander actor?
He was good in the company, man, but...
And it's because he chooses to be.
Right.
Well, I don't know. Mm-hmm. These actors that create their own doom.
Yeah. So Kevin Costner and Eddie Murphy should be in a buddy movie.
Yes. I mean, that's it. I mean, they are the Burt Reynolds of our generation.
Oh, my God.
All right.
Oh, Burt Reynolds should be in it, too.
I'm unapologetic about that. And also, Costner never responds to – his people never respond to email. I've tried to get Costner for years. But listen, watch him on Inside the Actor's Studio.
Mm-hmm. Well, what about the time he was on Bill Maher? Remember he was on Bill Maher, I think it was like 2004?
Yeah, that
he
seems
was
strange.
Acting weird, man.
Look, he used to be the everyman.
Yeah.
Everyone used to be so – he was so endearing.
Mm-hmm.
When did he turn out to be the blandest, most boring and unsurprising actor around? I liked him when he played Rascals, you know?
Yeah.
I liked him, Tin Cup, Silverado. But he's so predictable now. And you see him on his Inside the Actor Studio.
Mm-hmm.
He comes across as the biggest gas bag that ever lived. He really does. All right. Enough of that criticism.
Okay.
By the way, I'd love for you to do the show, Mr. Costner.
Kevin, we'd love you. He's made like...
There's a great chance of that, though.
No, the upside of Anger and The Company Men, though, are like two performances
exactly.
I like.
The upside of Anger, I mean, he's capable of playing a role that has some life to it,
mm-hmm.
You know?
Right.
Why does he have to brood all the time?
I know.
All right. Kirk Kenny, guys, we're going to close the show with him. Thank you, Jerry. Thank you, everyone.
No, thank you. It was a lot of fun. It was good, and we'll see everyone Sunday.
Sunday night. See you later. Good night. Bye.
Good night.
I'm 28. Yesterday, I was 15. The day before that, I was 30. The day before that, I was 8. One day, recently, I was past 90. Every day, I wake up at a different age, in a different year, on a different day of my life, and it's scaring the hell out of me. I want it to stop. I've been awake for the last 48 hours trying to get someone like you to talk to me because I don't know where I'm going to be once I fall asleep. Can you help me?
Did you come see me about 2 years ago?
For me, it was yesterday. Do you know what's happening to me?
Mm-hmm.
And you're saying what's happening to me is a present.
It's the only way you're going to learn.
Learn what?
Someone's in trouble, and you're the only one who can save them.
Who am I supposed to save?
Just pay attention.
Just pay attention.
It's time to pay attention to everything. But this is no use writing things down, because I certainly can't take it with me. I'm just going to have to remember everything. So, here I am, talking to myself. Where's my wife?
You have always taken care of me. And I promise, I will always be there to take care of you. No matter what.
You thought it was a bitch! Oh my God!
I want to see you happy. Tommy, pay attention.
You're never gonna stop.
26 years doesn't seem possible. It seems like just yesterday he was 8.
Actually, that was 2 days ago.
Shuffle, it was an idea that I batted around with another executive friend of mine about maybe 7 years ago, and he was working at this company and was talking about maybe hiring me to write it for them, and we sort of, you know, talked about the idea because he'd read something of mine and saw that I liked, that he'd liked a lot, that he'd saw that played around with structure a lot, and so we started throwing about this idea of like a person who lived their life out of order and what did that even mean, and I came up with... An outline and some ideas, and he, you know, he was expecting more of a broad comedy, and I came in with more of like Twilight Zone meets Frank Capra kind of a thing.
Yeah.
And so that he was kind of like, oh, well, this isn't what we had in mind, but if you write it, let us know if it goes out, and yeah, as a spec. And I'm like, oh, okay, sure. And then I set about writing it, and then when I was like on page 60 of my first draft, I think my managers called me up and said, got some bad news. And I said, what? And they said, Chris Columbus just sold a script to Warner Brothers about a guy who lives his life out of order. And I'm like, Oh, okay. So I finished the script up, but it could never go out at that time because the log lines sounded too similar, you know, and then the other sale had just been made. So I kind of put it on the shelf, but also always thought it had potential to be kind of a cool little low-budget picture. And I shortly thereafter made a short film called Validation with my friend T.J. Thine, who is now one of the stars of the TV show Bones. He and I went to school together at USC, and when we were shooting Validation, I started thinking, you know, Shuffle could be a really good vehicle for TJ. He'd actually be great for this. And I showed it to him, and we started talking about it, and then eventually, a couple of years ago, and he was coming up on his hiatus, and he didn't have anything going on that summer, and neither did I, and we were like, hey, well, why don't we put this together and finally do it? And I was like, great, okay, cool. So that was kind of how it came together.
So nothing ever became of that Chris Columbus movie?
As far as I know, it's still sort of in, you know, the development world of on-the-shelf kind of thing.
Development hell, yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, I've never heard any more about it.
Good.
So I just know that it sold, and I just sort of heard things from the grapevine, so what I'm saying may have no bearing on reality, but I heard that they never got an actor attached to push it forward, so... Yeah, it may pop up at some point. I don't know, but
forget about the Chris Columbus movie. Let's
yeah,
talk about
well, it was, from what I understand, very different from what I did. Anyway, it was just that the sentences sounded the same if you're talking about it. So.
Mm-hmm. So when you sit down to write a screenplay like a Shuffle, obviously you're playing with structure, and you have some conceits that you're dealing with, sort of a time traveling kind of aspect to it. Do you sit down and watch particular films for inspiration to see how they do certain things, or do you avoid that altogether?
I try to avoid that because I don't want to end up copying anything. If anything, I might watch other movies to see what they did to make sure that I'm trying not to do the same thing. Because Shuffle really isn't a time travel movie, though it may sound like it from the description. I'm also not foolish enough to compete with Back to the Future. No one can touch that as far as I'm concerned. So I would never even go near that one. But this was. But what I kept thinking of this more is like the Twilight Zone or that sort of thing, or It's a Wonderful Life or something. So I was kind of looking at it from that perspective. But from this, what I was really kind of more interested in was kind of the way character could be revealed in unusual ways by layers coming off, by things being revealed out of sequence, if you know what I mean.
Right.
So that was what I thought was most interesting about this is, you know, he visits, you know, he's a certain day in his life and his life is a certain way, and then he goes back earlier and visits his life at another place, and he's like, well, wait a minute, things are like this here. How did they get to be like that over here? I don't. What happened in this gap that I just didn't visit? So
right.
I always thought the thing that was interesting about this script was that, unlike a movie that progresses linearly, the question is not how things will turn out because you kind of know that because you were just there. The question is how did they get that way? So,
mm-hmm.
And I found that to be a lot of fun to play with in the construction of the screenplay.
And a very unique challenge, I would think, first of all, to write, very, very tricky, to keep all those strands together.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of
mapping.
Exactly. Yeah, I mean, you did a lot of that.
I did, yeah. No, it's just to kind of keep track of, like, okay, where are we here, where are we there, and, you know, what does this happen? You know, you do timelines, you do graphs that sort of go, you know, parallel next to each other, and you kind of have to have those sort of in front of you while you're writing.
Yeah.
So that you always know where on the map that you are.
And plus for TJ... it would be a unique challenge to build a performance in that manner as well.
Absolutely. Yeah. Also, what was interesting is because, you know, in this movie, like, both his character and the character of the female lead, Grace, are played by, you know, a couple different actors. So they would kind of, I noticed, like, TJ and Paula Rhodes, who played the adult version of Grace in the film, that they would kind of be watching their children counterparts to see their mannerisms, and they sometimes noticed the kids watching them. And also the actor, Chris Stone, who played TJ's father in the film, TJ would be watching him, and they'd be kind of like, sort of, you'd start to see, like, the actors kind of develop mannerisms that they would share between each other, kind of to keep it together. That was really interesting to watch, too.
Wow.
And sometimes I hadn't even noticed it during the shoot. I would discover when I was editing the movie, looking at it, going, "Oh my God, they they decided to share that, and they never told me. You know, like I'd find little subtle things that they were doing character-wise to kind of keep a continuity that I thought was pretty cool.
And again, you're an army of one.
In post-production, anyway.
Directing, writing, editing, scoring, on and on and on. I mean, is that you're intimately involved in the process from the very beginning to the very end, through every step of it. I mean, is that kind of essential to you, and how important is it for you to get kind of an outside perspective of how others view what you're doing on the film while you're doing it?
You know, I it's interesting. I've sort of changed my perspective on that over time. I used to really kind of enjoy the idea of just sort of crafting a movie like a novel, like you're by yourself kind of doing all these different jobs sequentially, the writing, the directing, the editing, the music, the, you know, even doing my own Foley walking or whatever kind of thing. But at a certain point you realize, if I keep doing this, I'm only going to make like 5 more movies before I die, you know, so this takes forever. And also, like Dear Zachary was made that way. It was basically me by myself in my bedroom doing everything, and nobody really saw anything until I was done. And there's something kind of nice and hermetic and comforting about working that way, but also at a certain point it does get a little bit exhausting. And I've just been finding, as I've been getting older, it is more fun to have other people around and having outside perspectives and things, and you burn out a lot less. I'm hoping this is the last time I do all of those jobs. Also, to be quite honest, a lot of it is a budgetary thing too.
So
I did have 2 brilliant guys doing visual effects for me on this picture and post. That was the one other, and I had, of course, a fantastic orchestra doing the, playing my score, and a contractor who brought them in, an engineer who recorded and mixed all that stuff and was great. But apart from that, post was pretty much me on my own. And yeah, I've done that for many, many years. And quite honestly, I feel like in the future I'd like to maybe co-edit with somebody else. Just might be more kind of less lonely and have somebody else do the sound design. You know,
I can imagine you'd feel kind of bleary-eyed or bleary-minded after a while, kind of numbed out and not sure. But I think this is what happens to all filmmakers when they're so deeply embedded in something and they lose their perspective on whether or not it's working. So they need an outside set of eyes to tell them.
Oh, sure. Well, I always bring in other people to watch it as I'm cutting, too. Like, friends. I actually showed like this to the same set of people that I was showing Dear Zachary to while I was cutting it and everything. And was kind of like, what do you think? Is this working? Whatever. And, it's difficult, because there's no score in, the visual effects aren't in, there's no sound design in, and, the look of the movie isn't finished, all those things. So they're having to kind of make an enormous number of mental leaps to try to see where I'm going to be going with this,
Mm-hmm.
So, that's the same thing like when Dear Zachary, when I first thought I was finished, people came to me and was like, dude, you need to chop like 30 more minutes out of this. And I was like, I do? Because it was like a 2-hour cut, and everyone else kind of prevailed on me to trim it down to 90 minutes. And, similar thing happened with this too. Like I would realize that it was too long and I trimmed it down, and other things we changed about, the look of it and whatnot too as we went along. So it, with both of those pictures, it was kind of a process afterward to kind of, hone it, if you will.
And see, this film feels so kind of tight and precise. I mean,
thanks.
Things have to fall a certain way. So I couldn't imagine that there was much you had to cut out from it. But
I trimmed out about 5 minutes from from what I originally thought was the finished cut, because I was showing it to some friends of mine who had read the script and been huge fans of it, and they were watching it, and it was the finished mixed movie and everything. I said, what do you think? And they're like, it's good. I'm really into it. I'm emotionally ill. Like, I was crying at the end of it. I said, it's a little slower than I was anticipating. I was like, I was feeling the same thing while we were sitting here and watching it, and I'm glad to hear no one else has verbalized that yet. So I sat down and looked at it with them again and then went through it myself, and I just started being really hard. Because, the movie's only 82 minutes, so even 5 minutes longer was only 87, and the script was 90 pages. So I wasn't, looking for stuff to cut because it wasn't over long. But it wasn't so much that. It was just the movie wanted to move a little faster. And, when you have something like in the case of Dear Zachary, I had a documentary that was 2 hours and people were saying it should be 90 minutes. That's a very significant difference. And, even as a marketplace thing too. But when you're doing the difference between 87 minutes and 82 minutes, oftentimes people wouldn't be looking for things to cut at that length, but it just was more like, this just wants to move a little more briskly. So I went back and did the work. And recut my entire score in the process, too.
Oh, gosh. Oh, man. What's that
thing about that? Because you don't want to make it seem like the... I had that same problem with Dear Zachary, too. I had written and mixed the entire score on the two-hour version, and I had to recut the movie and the score to fit it. So in both cases, I was like, I hope this doesn't turn the music into, like, Frankenstein's monster. But it seems to have worked out in both cases.
I love that score to Dear Zachary. Is that available anywhere?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, I'm going to finally make it available online very soon, where people can, you know, hopefully get it off of either like CD Baby or iTunes or Amazon and whatnot. At the moment, I just have it, so if people want to email me through the Dear Zachary site or through shufflethemovie.com, I can certainly sell it to you directly as well, too, for the meantime. But that should be available in the next couple of months. So I'm finally starting to make all of my music available because I have this back library that people are of all the scores I've done that people keep asking me, where are those? And I'm like, I've been so busy making these films, I haven't attended to that side of things. So I'm finally getting that taken care of soon.
Well, it's a beautiful score, but the process of putting together a documentary is one thing. I mean, and it truly is a process. I mean, it could take years of collecting footage and on and on and on. Feature film is obviously very different. you're dealing with a budget, I'm thinking probably a short schedule. What kind of schedule did you have in this one?
22 days.
Wow.
With 195 scene numbers. Because there's a lot of jump around. People on the set were saying, I have never seen so many wardrobe changes on one movie before. Plus, we had Barney Berman, who shortly after our shoot won the Oscar for best makeup for his work on Star Trek, the J.J. Abrams Star Trek a couple of years ago.
He was on our show talking about it, yeah.
Yeah. Oh, he was? Oh, great. Oh, yeah. He did all of our old age makeup, and even though we couldn't afford him, he just loved the script and loved my other work. And he and TJ had worked together on the Jim Carrey How the Grinch Stole Christmas film a few years ago, he just really wanted to do it and spent the summer with us. And it was, I was just astonished by everything I saw coming out of his workshop. He's just so talented.
Phenomenal.
He was able to make TJ play anywhere from like age 21 to 92 over the course of the film.
Wow. That is a special gift because old age makeup, because when we think makeup, we think things like Star Trek, they're really kind of outlandish, but to make natural looking old age makeup is a special talent, I think.
Mm-hmm. And one of the things in the film, because people are always paying attention to TJ's character because he's the one jumping around in time, but the actors playing his parents are the ones who actually spend 80% of the movie under prosthetic makeup, and most people don't notice that because they are only playing their real ages when they are playing opposite, like the 10-year-old actor I have, playing the young version of TJ. So that any scenes they have with TJ himself, they're always under various stages of prosthetic makeup, and most people I've noticed watching the movie just notice that the parents age because that's, of course they're aging, that's what they do, and then later they go think back and wait a minute. They couldn't have been like, oh my God, that was makeup. It's interesting that people are really, when I've noticed when reactions to the movie, people are really paying attention to the makeup on TJ as like the feature, but they almost don't notice the brilliant subtle work that Barney has been doing on all the other people surrounding him as the age changes. Mm. So I found that to be a very kind of interesting phenomenon that, sometimes his work is so good and so seamless that people don't even know he did it.
Yeah. I guess that's the goal.
Yeah.
So he's
true.
Great at it.
We kept him very busy. He had like at least 9 or 10 different old age makeups on this picture.
Wow.
Yeah, he did have a team of people working with him, but it wasn't that. It was like he had maybe 2 or 3 people helping him, and that was it.
But in terms of the pace of making a film like this in 22 days, obviously you have to move fast, but do you know when you've got a scene or when a scene is working, or is there always a certain uncertainty and you just have to fly past it? Or
there were only a couple times when I went back and reshot something that I would get home that night and look at it and go, no, we got to go back. But generally it's like you don't really have time for that. You just got to get something and make it work somehow and keep going, particularly on a schedule such as ours. So you really just got to push through it. That's what I found anyway.
And when you showed it to what festival did you just premiere at?
We were Friday night. We were at the Hollywood Film Festival at the ArcLight here in Los Angeles, then we were on the first night of that, and then Saturday night we were the closing night film of the Heartland Film Festival in Indianapolis, and So that's where we just were this weekend. So it was kind of TJ and I, like, basically we were at the screening Friday night in L.A. and partied with everybody until about 1:15. Then we went and, like, got picked up to go to the airport, flew at 6 a.m., landed in Indianapolis, went right to the screen, and came right back. So I've had, like, no sleep all weekend, but it was so much fun. It was worth it.
Oh, I bet it was. But
yeah,
the
reaction
that?
Was terrific. We had sold-out houses at both. The people were just so generous, and during the Q&A in Heartland, they gave us a standing ovation after the picture, so it was really nice to see it with, because I made this, like, for, you know, regular folks, really, kind of thing, and to see, like, particularly the reaction in Heartland was just so wonderful, because they've been such big fans of my short film series, which includes that film Validation that TJ and I made together, which is, mm-hmm. It's on YouTube if anybody wants to see it. It's got, like, 6 million hits or something now. It's kind of popped around and done well, so it was really, really gratifying after all this time to you know, come out of the gate with that kind of reaction this weekend.
It's got to be gratifying to see your movie for the first time through the audience's eyes.
Mm-hmm. It's taken me a long time, because generally every time I've shown it to people, all I'm staring at is the technical stuff, like, oh God, I didn't do that right. Oh God, I got to go fix that before I show it again. All that. And this weekend, particularly Saturday night in Indianapolis, was when the first time in maybe, you know, in months, I don't know how long, but I was actually found myself getting caught up in the story with the audience. There was, like, an energy in the room that you could really feel. Everybody was getting it. You could sort of hear even vocal responses to, like, people going, oh, that, you know, like, that sort of thing. You could really hear it and feel it, and, you know, they were laughing in all the right places and getting it. And that was the first time in a long time that I was found myself actually getting sucked into the story. And that was really special for me, because I can't remember the last time that happened. Because I, like, with this, you know, when you work on something and you're staring at it every day for, you know, 2 years, you could be looking at, you know, the wall. You know, certainly you just don't even know what you're looking at anymore.
Right.
So,
well, that's great. So what are the future plans for it? You have, if you could tell our audience, the screenings in November.
Absolutely. Well, next up, we're screening at we're at the St. Louis International Film Festival on November 20th, and then we're at the Cinema Society of San Diego down here on November 29th, and we are waiting to hear, you know, we have a bunch of other dates getting lined up for, like, you know, December and January and festivals all through, like, the early part of next year. And I'm not at liberty to talk about it yet, but we do have some people we're talking to as far as, you know, parties that, as far as releasing the movie. So look for it to be coming out commercially, like, spring, summer of next year.